Hopefully this is a talk you were expecting. You were probably expecting there'd be two of me. The other one of me is ill and couldn't be here today, alas. So instead, I had to prepare the whole talk on 3 days' notice by myself. So I hope your standards are low today. I am currently president of a virtual world startup called Aria, and that is the last piece of product placement you will hear till the end of the talk. It seems like every damn web conference I've been to in the last few years, there's been at least one talk, one panel, one session, one bit of blathering from a stage telling you that you need to pay more attention to games. Are you guys as sick of hearing this as I am?
No?
You're here because you want to hear more? So, I'm a game designer. That's what I do. I'm stepping over into the web world kind of on the side just because Tim keeps asking me to come to conferences. I am actually a little tired of hearing the same old things over and over again about how you can use games in order to improve your web applications. So, because of that, I'm not even going to try, frankly. I'm going to give you some lessons from game design, and you can tell me whether you think they're useful to you, okay? So, the interesting thing about that is, whenever we come to these sessions, they're almost always about interface, and they're always about these same things. You gotta have 5-little-star ranking systems, and you gotta have ratings, and you gotta have publicly viewable profiles, and you know, all of that stuff, right? Which hopefully we all learned from eBay years ago and can move past now. So instead, here's what I'm going to do. I decided to grab around 35 random lessons from game design and game development, and I'm going to tell you 35 little stories. And you can tell me whether or not those actually have any relevance to what you're working on. Maybe they will and maybe they won't. But sometimes the things that came out of these little anecdotes have turned out to be surprising to us over on the game development side. So maybe they'll be surprising and interesting for you guys. Because of that, there will be no order or sequence whatsoever to this talk. It will jump around like crazy. Hopefully you like shifting context rapidly. So here's the first lesson that I'm going to present to you. Once upon a time, in a game I worked on called Ultima Online, there was a spree of murders. The guilty party was this guy named Tinkerboy. Tinkerboy liked to pile up explosives into chests, leave them on the road where other unsuspecting players would wander over, look inside, get blown to bits, they would detonate other nearby chests until chain reactions of explosive, highly improvised explosive devices would rip through the countryside, leaving hundreds dead. He was the number one killer in Ultima Online. He had 14,000 player deaths to his credit. The average number of kills that a player had in that game was 2. This is a manifestation of something that maybe you guys have all heard of called Pareto's Law, Zipf distributions. Holler out if these are familiar. I expect interactivity. This is a games talk. Holler out. Yes. Good. Good. The cool thing about these distributions is the shocking realization that the average person is below average. Okay? The typical user, which is to say the definition of average using the word median, is typically below the mean in whatever it is that they're doing. Just about anything that you can ask a user to do demands some skill. There are people out there who still can't drive a mouse. I know that's hard for you to believe because you're from Silicon Valley, but it's true. There are people out there who still have great difficulty in doing things like downloading files, determining that the yellow bar at the top of their browser means install a plugin, and so on. The average user is below the average standard that we tend to design towards. Because our perceptions are distorted by the high-end users so badly. What's more, we should never forget that users are always competing with one another as to how well they can use something. And that means that your typical user always feels like an idiot. because they are the one who loses 13,998 times to Tinker Boy, who's the expert who knows how to use the system. So my first lesson to throw out there for you guys today is, remember, in any kind of design, now the lesson we learned from games is, you got to have ways for these guys to feel competent from the get-go. And the way games do this, by the way, is this thing called leagues. You guys all familiar with leagues? Yeah. So, just a thought, I don't usually see website designs that divide users into levels of competence and give them leagues. Might be something useful for you guys. Have the junior league versus the advanced league at using your photo sharing site. Number two might seem obvious. Nobody reads the manual. So here's an interesting thing I'm going to present to you guys. Any of you guys console gamers? How many dimensions of interface, meaning axes, buttons, and so on, are on the average console controller today?
Sixteen to eighteen.
On this. Right? Just on that little thing there. And yet, most games succeed at getting players all the way through the experience without them ever needing to check any reference material at all. You guys familiar with Miller's number? No. Nobody here in the cognitive psych? And you guys do interface design? George A. Miller, who coincidentally hung out a lot with Licklider, whom you should know because he's a comp sci kind of guy. Cognitive psych and computer science actually were intertwined. They actually roomed together at MIT when the fields were born. George Miller determined that the number of things that a typical person can hold in their head is 7 plus or minus 2. Have you heard this before?
Yes.
Okay. Seems like a controller with 18 kind of blows that away, yet everybody is able to pick it up instantly. Why is that? It's because games make heavy use of a term from interface design called affordances. You guys familiar with that?
No.
Yeah. Yes, no. When you walk up to a door, does it drive you totally freaking bananas when you've got this horizontal bar and a little sign above it that says pull? Or the little vertical bar and you have to push? Those are backwards affordances, okay? The reason why games get away with these dense controllers with a zillion controls is because the actual activities that you do haptically map to exactly what you expect them to do. Poster child today is the Wii. You pick up the thing, and what can you do with it? Well, basically nothing. You can swing it around. But what do you know? Everything designed for it is a game of swinging it around. Therefore, there's zero learning curve. You can apply this to all forms of interaction design. Think about what exactly are the tasks that you want people to accomplish on your site, on your interface. And make sure that the interface movements and motions and metaphors are ones that precisely match what they expect to do anyway. That's why pushing forward on the stick works, even though today's joystick is an analog stick with 3 degrees of analog motion on it, which if I gave it to you as a standalone control would baffle just about everybody but a jet pilot. And yet, 5-year-olds can navigate with it just fine. Shifting gears. Shocking little statistic here. One of the things that video games have taught us is that, well, men are from Mars through the ages of 16 through 25. And the rest of the time, they like to live at Venus. There are, for better or for worse, significant cognitive and behavioral differences between the genders when engaging with technology, of a variety of sorts. Are these stereotypes? Hell yeah. Do they apply to any given individual? No. Do they apply statistically across the user base? Yes. What does this mean? It means that when you run into a cute female cleric in World of Warcraft, you have higher odds of it actually being a female than if you run into a barbarian. Because females tend to gravitate towards certain roles within the game framework. They tend to do certain sorts of things. It isn't necessarily always the Florence Nightingale stereotype either. Second in commands of guilds, meaning the person who actually makes everything work and run, tends to be female. Number one's usually some blustering guy, but number two is the exec assistant who's the one we all secretly know runs the company. When you look at the distribution curve for people playing games in the hardcore game market, what you see is this great huge bulge of men, and then it trails off as it reaches towards older age. And the women start out low and rise to a certain percentage and stay completely leveled throughout the ages. By the time you're talking about 60-year-old users of your system, you find gender balance, which is an interesting phenomenon. Similarly, if you look at the things that typically appeal to women, casual games, puzzle games, healing, crafting, things like that, what you find is that the proportion of women engaging in it rises over time, and the proportion of men actually rises over time, because older men have behavioral patterns that are less driven by, well, testosterone-driven blowing shit up. So the thing I guess I would throw out for you guys is consider, when you're designing for your demographic, consider that the 35-year-old married guy is very likely to actually fit into a psychographic a lot more like your female users will. They're more likely to want to engage in community building, nurturing kinds of activities, and things that are socially constructive rather than destructive. Any of you guys heard this term, cozy worlds?
Mm-hmm.
Once upon a time, we spent a few million dollars. Okay, it was over 10 million. Building these beautiful, giant, seamless worlds where you could see to the horizon like Balboa seeing the Pacific. And it was about as interesting, too. Procedurally generated landscapes that ran for miles and, you know, well, mostly a whole lot of stuff that wasn't interesting, right? It turns out, and you'll hear me reference this again later, it turns out that humans in general aren't actually fans of giant expanses of anything. It turns out that humans prefer what are called cozy worlds. This is something that's actually very well known to architects. Anybody been to Vegas lately? In Vegas, all the buildings are designed so that your line of sight never runs more than a few, well, tens of yards. They'll even go to the length of changing the ceiling height to make sure that they cut off your view. Each of these segmented areas will be themed differently, subtly, sometimes via lighting, carpeting, paint, whatever it is, in order to give you that sense that you've crossed the boundary between one space and another. And today, the most popular virtual worlds are, in fact, not the ones where we simulated the state of New York virtually with endless empty rolling hills, but the ones with distinctive chopped-up locales designed to hold a particular reasonably sized group of people that I will refer to later as Dunbar's number, or the monkey sphere. You guys heard either of those terms? This applies to your community building. How many of you run forums today? How many of you have a general discussion forum? Shut it down. The effect of non-cozy worlds and endless expanses is a shredding of social fabric and an increase in customer service costs. Because cozy worlds encourage peer pressure and social norming, and large worlds do not. I'll get back to that in a little bit, but for now, the lesson is you design for the right size, which, by the way, for almost every field of human endeavor, turns out to be 150. Designing bigger is just a waste of time. It will actually increase your headaches. So once upon a time, we had this lever that we built into the dungeon Despise, and there were some code numbers next to it, and everybody came to it, and they tried to figure out what it did. And after all, every other lever in the game, when you pulled it, you know, a door opened, or a platform triggered or a trap turned on or off or something. And this particular lever, well, you know, the guy who was working on it never quite finished, but it was in the game anyway, so it did jack shit. This was a problem. This was one of the single most reported bugs on the entire platform. Why? Because of the other levers. If there hadn't been any working levers, it wouldn't have been an issue. But unfortunately, we had some working examples. When users interact with a piece of software of any sort, they're building a mental model of how it works. This mental model is wrong, and it doesn't matter. They have expectations about how the way the world works, right? Kind of like we expect that when we drop things, they always go down. Well, that mental model is wrong, because there isn't really a down, right? There's kind of more like an inwards towards the center of mass of our planet, which isn't really down. Down to us is, you know, it's a local illusion. But it doesn't matter. We can cope with down. Users cope with levers always do something. They build mental models. If you have an interface widget anywhere in your system that happens to look like a different interface widget someplace else and does not do exactly the same thing, it will be reported as a bug. Because the mental model has been violated. Users prize consistency in terms of how they poke and prod their mental model. If they push on something everywhere else, they expect to be able to push on it the next time they see it. How many of you have kids? You know that whole thing about tell them once and it's a habit? I'm going to tell you about my friend Damien. He has a mom. His mom plays Bejeweled and Snood 30 hours a week. We have found that the whole notion of casual user versus hardcore user is generally completely erroneous. We have this notion, oh, our product is for casual users. A product for casual users is a dead product. It does not exist because casual users don't stick to anything. If you don't have hardcore users of your incredibly lightweight activity, it's going to go away. Bejeweled and Snood and all these other so-called casual games are actually driven by these obsessive people who sit there and build strategy guides for how to maximize their Snoods. There isn't really any such thing as a casual, successful product. Instead, what you have is a spectrum, once again following that classic power law, of people who invest lots of intensity and time and effort in it, and people who only invest a little. And if you don't hit the high end of that curve, your product's going to die. The lesson here is, we keep trying to build products for casual markets, and there is no such thing. You're always searching for the passion. You're always aiming towards whatever keeps people really, truly engaged. And then there's the flip side of this coin. Anybody here old school enough to have been a turn-based wargamer? Yeah, you guys are so screwed, right? I mean, have you been able to find one on the shelf lately? How about hardcore military vehicle simulation players? Any of those left? Yeah, the reason there aren't any is because of him. Adventure gamers, anybody? So these are all what get called dead genres. Here's what happens. Somebody comes up with a cool new game idea, and it gets out there, and people dig it, and then it becomes more popular, and more people play it, and pretty soon they are clamoring at the gates of the developer saying, we love this kind of game. You really, really, really need to add, well, let's make it the conference-going game. It's really cool that you've added badges and coffee stands, but now what we really, really want is the chance to have procedurally generated parties that happen at 3 a.m. where we can bump into VCs. And pretty soon the feature creep takes over the project, driven by your hardcore users. And the result of that is that new users have no freaking clue what to do when they get there. So they stop buying them. And that is why there is no hardcore flight simulation market, and there is no wargaming market, because they started doing things like simulating the effect of morale on rifle upkeep in World War I. And you know, pretty soon everyone's like, what the hell is this? I don't... A rifle upkeep? Audiences are what kill genres. I submit to you that we may have seen this happening with social networking. One of the big panaceas that we always talk about with games is, oh, you know, we've got this guy who sucks at the game. Wouldn't it be great if the game could help the guys who are really lousy and make it easier for them and make it automatically harder for the guys who are really good at something? This is called adaptive difficulty. If any of you play racing games, you've probably noticed that when you're running last, you get better handling of your car, higher acceleration, and... kind of neat. Or if you play a platformer, you'll notice that if you die a lot, all of a sudden those crates start having lots more free lives in them. So recently a game came out called Oblivion. Anybody played Oblivion? You know, the number one gripe against Oblivion, other than ninjas bouncing through the forest collecting flowers? The number one gripe against Oblivion is that it is exactly the same difficulty no matter what your skill level is. You come to it as a newbie, and it is perfectly tuned so that you win 7 out of 10 times. You come to it as a total badass, and you win 7 out of 10 times. You go back to an easy level where there used to be stuff that, you know, was trivial, and you want to go back and feel powerful by crushing it, and everything's been upgraded, and you win 7 out of 10 times. You're a newbie, and you go into the most dangerous, darkest dungeon where the blades are sharp and the icky grooves are really icky, and you win 7 out of 10 times. This is bad. The problem with adaptive difficulty is that some people like having harder and easier experiences. Fun comes from operating at the margin of your ability. And if there's no chance of catastrophic failure, it isn't fun anymore. And I submit to you that a sin that a lot of websites do, since they're aiming at increasing productivity and so on, is that they delete the chance of failure from the spec. If you want an engaging experience, you need to let people try something and fail at it, and you need to present things to them that are hard to do, because what users really find engaging is not winning predictably 7 out of 10 times, but being the 1 in 100 who actually made that feature work and be a total badass and tell all their friends about it. That's what makes things fun. Similarly, bottom feeding. So in all these virtual world games that I work on, it's a really common pattern. There you are at level 10, you want to get to level 11. All the monsters are color-coded. There's red ones, there's blue ones, there's yellow ones, there's green ones, whatever. You could go after the red one, which will give you this great extra special bonus and reward, and, you know, but it'll be hard. I mean, odds are 50-50 that you'll die. Or instead, you could kill 10,000 rats. You kill the 10,000 rats, each one is plink, plink, plink. Very unlikely that the rat will happen to bite into your leg and happen to hit the femoral artery. You know, it's just, it doesn't happen very often, so you bottom feed. This is the most mindlessly boring, numbing, soul-crushing experience known to man. We call it grinding. It's a lot like, actually, corporate careers, come to think of it. And it also isn't fun. Again, fun comes from operating at the margin of your ability. If here you are tackling things that are guaranteed wins, it's incredibly depressing. Any form of repetitive task for fixed reward sucks. And if you're having to build in shortcuts into your application to build macros to automate repetitive tasks, you really should be asking yourself why those were a bunch of little tasks in the first place. Because any form of repetitive, zero-challenge task sucks. High ROI is a bad word in interaction design. The reason for that is because it's boring, right? The Photoshop guy really does not want to sit there making 10,000 thumbnails or even writing the macro to make 10,000 thumbnails. He's much more interested in making one really cool thumbnail. That's what he finds challenging and interesting. Let's switch gears again. interesting thing happened. There's a stereotype out there. You know, we're examining the psychology of cameras, trying to figure out, well, okay, what gives us the largest market? Should this next new game, this new virtual world, should it have that overhead isometric camera, or should it be first person? And we go out there, and there's all these studies about, for example, we want to appeal to a broader audience, we want to have women playing this particular game. Women apparently suffer more from motion sickness, just statistically again, it's one of those things, kind of odd. But to our shock, what we found was that women prefer first-person cameras pretty dramatically over men. Men actually prefer the third-person cameras. That was interesting. But it was more than that. It turned out that the people who liked to kill other people in the game preferred the third-person cameras. The people who enjoyed combat more preferred the third-person cameras. Even though the roles that the women tended to be playing, such as healing and group coordination, were exactly the roles that called for having a wide field of view and knowing about everybody else around and having a sense of context, it didn't matter. They still would rather be first person and have a lousy perspective on what's going on than be in third person and actually be able to see what's happening. Why? Because it turned out the third-person cameras objectify things. The smaller the representation of the other user on screen, the easier it was to regard them as just a game token rather than another person. So if you're a player killer, you actually want all the other avatars to be as small and insignificant as possible so that you may crush them with abandon. Whereas if what you're interested in doing is having social relationships, then what you actually want is to have first-person perspectives on things. You want to be able to see the faces, even if there's no decent facial animation. And this carries through into all kinds of things. We found, for example, that it's a sad truth, I know this because I'm only 5'7", short people get snubbed more. You guys all know this? In real life, short people get snubbed more. And in our games, we keep building dwarves and hobbits and whatever, right? Well, guess what? They get snubbed a lot more in the games. And this is something for you guys to think about. I don't know, maybe you're building avatars. Maybe you just have av icons. You might want to think about, what is the size of your icons? Do you allow full body little icons, or do you allow heads only? How much screen real estate do they take up? Do you allow camera pitches from above or below? Because it turns out that the choice of whether or not an avatar is seen pitched from above or below will in fact determine how users treat that person. If it's pitched from below, they will treat them with greater deference because their perception is that they are shorter than they are. In fact, avatars... So, I've got this friend. For as long as I've known, I've been online gaming with this guy since 1990... Oh, God. 1990. For as long as I've known him, here's what he has played. He played a giant troll who was mute. He played an ogre who was taciturn. He played a huge orc who didn't talk. He played a gargoyle once that didn't speak the language. It's kind of curious. People choose exactly the same virtual representations of themselves consistently over the course of years. And why is that? It's because it's a mask that they're choosing to present. Avatars represent aspects of your own psychology that you are pushing outwards. And the interesting thing about that... Oh, that's lovely. My laptop just locked up. We will just reboot it now. The interesting thing about that is that the choices people make as to what to present essentially act as filters on their behavior. If you present as the petite little blonde princess, you will tend to act as the petite little blonde princess. If you present as the giant taciturn warrior, you will tend to act as the giant taciturn warrior. And people are pretty consistent about this. The interesting thing is that people also don't like being pigeonholed as the petite blonde princess. We all contain multitudes, right? So what people do is that they choose to have, course. Now this is going to boot up publicly instead of on my screen. What do people tend to do is that they build galleries of personas. Just as sometimes you dress up formally or you dress up in a t-shirt, just as sometimes you wear your hair spiky or you comb it back, just as you do different hairdos, different clothing for different social situations, avatars work the same way. They're masks and filters. I realize it's a big customer service headache, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But if you support only one identity and one possible persona, one possible mode of expression, you are not actually capturing all of your user. And they will go someplace else to express that hidden, goth, and piercing part of themselves rather than doing it on your site. So remember, personalities are multifarious and varied. Let's see. In theory, I can do that. Ha, look at that, the magic of technology. Of course, I have no idea what slide came next.
We'll wait.
Challenging moment. You'll wait because it's been fascinating, huh? Oh, let me see.
There were no orders.
They're in no order, so I'll throw out another one that I happen to remember from elsewhere. I'll harken back to Dunbar's number. We did an interesting thing, actually. We measured the size of guilds in the games. You guys familiar with the notion of guilds? Anybody not familiar with the notion of guilds? All right, just enough that I have to explain it. You guys know about bowling leagues. You know about teams of various sorts where people who enjoy playing things together gather together in social groups. Maybe they even elect a leader formally or informally, and they get together in order to do stuff together. Well, it turns out that once again that creepy monkey sphere thing pops up. What we end up seeing is that people tend to form into groups of 150. And it really doesn't matter whether or not you try building in systems to allow them to go larger. When we graphed the size populations of our communities, what we found is that there was a clear knee at 150. And what that meant was that people simply didn't form groups that were larger than that unless they had the capability to form subgroups. What's more, there was even an optimum size. So if you are forming any kind of technology, really, for allowing group aggregation into clumps of users, your sweet spot happens to be 30 to 60. And exceeding 150 is for the extreme minority, because that's just not a natural size. You guys, how many of you have heard of Dunbar's number? Robin Dunbar, anthropologist, measured the density of human social connections, how many people you can really know, by measuring cortical density in the human brain. Turns out the answer is 148.6. That's the most people you can ever care deeply about at one time. It's kind of a surprise when you go back through history, you find that successful companies start breaking at 150. The average peak military unit size throughout all of history is 150, and so on down the line. It's a very consistent number. So consistent that Dunbar's number is also known as the rule of 150. Any of you ever studied this curve in your lit classes? No, because none of you took lit classes because you're all coder geeks. But you all played Space Invaders. Space Invaders. Every once in a while. All right, yeah. So, the thing is, when was the last time that you played a shooter where all things did was march at you endlessly? That's not the way it works anymore, is it? Instead, you do the dun 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 dun, and all of a sudden, boom, ta-dum, and in comes this giant robot thing spewing billions of bullets. A boss battle, right? It turns out that smooth ramps are antithetical to human enjoyment. We talk about easing people in smoothly into a task. It's a really bad idea. It turns out that what people enjoy is actually bumpy roads, where they learn to master a challenge that ramps up smoothly, and then they face a big test. And then it drops back down in difficulty after that. And then they creep up again, and they face a big test again. This holds true across the board. This is the classic structure of the successful novel, piece of music, movie. Every form of human entertainment follows this curve. And games have evolved to this as well. But our application software hasn't, which is why it's boring. Users do whatever you reward them to do. It's kind of a sad thing. So, yeah, we made a system for punishing player killers where basically we didn't want people to kill each other. So we told them, well, if you kill somebody, a bounty is going on your head. And we're going to post the bounties on this board so that everybody else will hunt you down and exterminate you. Basically, we made a high score table for antisocial behavior. Users will do something they don't like to do simply because there is an incentive for it, such as go kill, plink, plink, 1,000 rats. People will avoid doing something they enjoy because it doesn't give them an incentive, and they watch the Joneses getting better at whatever it is that they're doing, so they go, I really love stamp collecting, but he makes more money as a real estate broker. So I'm going to be a real estate broker. And they will abandon their passions because that has more pats on the head. Watch your incentive structures in your applications incredibly carefully. This actually, right here, is the core of game design. Feedback loops and incentive structures. This is what we obsess over. How many of you guys would classify yourself as techno-libertarian geek idealists who want to change the world? I have really bad news for you. We very carefully built in systems so that guilds could vote in leaders and propose legislation for running their virtual towns, and you know they could arrive at consensus. There were ballot boxes and initiatives, and it was all a complete waste of time. Democracy does not naturally emerge in populations of less than 50,000 active participants. Eesh. Small groups of people prefer to be ruled by despotic leaders. And we've all had this experience, okay? We've all had the experience of some particular, maybe it was your gang of friends in college, the person who organized your book club, whatever it is. And one day that key individual went away and the whole group died, right? And that is because we're fundamentally tribal monkeys. And you have to provide support for that core individual person because they are the ones that are the social glue for everything else. If you're into social networking theory, this is the hub, right? We keep making a mistake of trying to build in all our ideals into these small systems, particularly since we're already following our earlier advice and building everything on scales of 150. At a scale of 150, you don't have democratically elected leaders. You have the charismatic prom queen. We also tend to build in things like levels of permission. Bad idea. Bad idea. Because if you've gone and constructed your really cool democratic system for people to vote in initiatives and whatever, the first thing players are going to want to do is say, I want to name this person dictator for life, and the second person executioner in high. And you're going to have not defined any roles for executioner on high because, well, it's antithetical to your personal deeply held belief system. We kept building guild systems where people were classified into tiers of permission. When in fact, what users want to do is adapt social structures to their needs. So if you have any system in your framework whatsoever, which is dependent upon the idea of one person having more power than another one, segment it by the individual power or capability, and not by tiers. Because all users will do is make you rewrite your system later when they say, oh, but I really need this person to also have the ability to delete the root directory. So there's the rules of Monopoly that are printed on the piece of paper. Then there's the rules of Monopoly that you're actually playing by, which say that that the money that you paid for jail sits under free parking and you collect it. That is nowhere in the printed rules of Monopoly. What is in the printed rules of Monopoly is Yeah, if you happen to reach over and snag some money out of the bank and nobody notices, more power to you. That is actually in the printed rules of Monopoly, interestingly. However, I've never played with anybody who would put up with that shit. So, there are three kinds of rules. Documented rules. We call those constitutive rules, because we're geeky game designers who like jargon. And then there's operational rules. And then finally, there's the social rules that are the customs and habits and practices. You are designers. You have to design all three sets of rules at once. And you have to design them to be different from one another because they don't actually match up. What this means is you're actually designing the social behaviors of your users when you tell them you can't upload a file here or you cannot post in this forum until you have this many points. They will arrive at social customs driven by your design. And the trick is you have to design all three of these things while only actually giving them the first set. You have to anticipate the ways in which you're going to bend them and break them. Y'all remember checkers? What board is checkers played on?
Chess.
A chess board. Really helpful. Let's pin that down more. What is a chess board?
A grid. 64.
A grid? 64? What? Squares? Circles?
Square.
Squares arranged? 8 by 8. You guys really have never played checkers, have you? Checkers is played on a diamond grid of 4 by 4 offset rows. Yes? Yes. The map is not the territory, is it? Right? Half the chessboard is not actually used in the game of checkers. You guys all played Asteroids? What is Asteroids played on? A torus. It wraps the top, bottom, and the edges, doesn't it? What is Defender played on?
Cylinder.
A Mobius strip. Any of you teach non-Euclidean geometry to your three-year-olds? Like chutes and ladders? The map is not the territory. Your interface lies about what your actual structure is, pretty much top to bottom. Games leverage this as much as they freaking can, because the more interesting the territory, frankly, a game played on a straight grid is really boring. Ask me sometime about the multidimensional topology of chess, which is, by the way, nowhere near being 2D. It's more like 9D, right? Your structures for activities need to be complex, interesting topologies. The paths the players take should not be boring and linear. Why? Because the whole world knows how to navigate 3D conceptual spaces trivially. We master that by age 1.5. What are interesting are complex multivariate spaces. And I don't mean just topologies of like where you go. I mean ranges of choices. I mean nestings. I mean conceptual linkages. That's what people find interesting. Way back when, I wonder how much time I have. But you guys will let me just keep going, right? Because I'm fascinated. Way back when in 1982, we spent very little money. And today we spend a lot. Like really, really enormous amounts. In fact, this is how many people it took to make a AAA game in 1982. This is how many it takes now. Content will kill you. In game design, the pinnacle of elegant game design is this. This actually is something I shouldn't need to tell a bunch of Web 2.0 geeks. Content sucks. If you're building it, anyway. Right? Because it is just insanely expensive. It drowns you. What you want to do in any of your products, whatever it is, okay, it doesn't even matter if it's a content-driven product, what you want is interesting combinations of few possibilities. Think about it. Deck of cards doesn't have that many things in it. There are thousands of card games. That's where the pinnacle of game design comes from. In a lot of ways, it's where the pinnacle of any application design comes from. And if you want to make a relationship here to the whole small pieces loosely joined, go nuts. I said that one already, didn't I?
Yeah.
Oh, you guys have problem users on your site? Funny thing, We had these bad users, so they get reported, so we banned one of them. And of course, we couldn't tell everybody that we banned them because, you know, it was a, you know, there's privacy concerns, and should we reveal that? And if we reveal it, then maybe we'll imitate them or whatever. Yeah, turns out that's not the effective method. The effective method is to let a whole bunch of bad guys pile up and then ban them all extremely loudly and publicly and say, we axed 10,000 accounts yesterday. And everybody will be a saint. In fact, don't even say why you did it. It turns out that human psychology really responds to the whole God will send a bolt of lightning from the blue and kill you. It actually makes people behave better to believe that they're capricious, ever-watching cops than to follow the rule of law. Disturbing bit of psychology. Of course, the whole publicizing thing is also absolutely true. Right. I mean, right now in the media, just to get serious for a moment, a lot of concern over copycat killings because of Virginia Tech. Absolutely true. I mean, how many of you guys have read the book Influence? All right, everybody go read the book Influence by Robert Cialdini. When it is reported in the news that a blonde-haired, blue-eyed, 23-year-old pre-med student wrapped his Porsche around a tree, the number of fatal crashes involving blonde-haired, medically inclined males driving sports cars spikes for the next 3 days. People are lemmings. In fact, they actually go and kill themselves unconsciously wrapping their cars around trees. Any behavior you publicize, you will get more of. Users also make shit up. A lot. One of my favorite features you ever put into Ultima Online was the Wisp language. This was randomly combined consonants that very occasionally would listen for something somebody else said nearby, pluck a word out of what they said, and repeat it back. There were entire websites devoted to decoding this secret language. You want to leave rough edges in your designs and leave things tantalizingly incomplete. This is the entire premise of the show Lost. Of course, you actually have to finish something sometime. But leave room for your users to mythologize and extend, okay? There should be a rumor that somewhere on your website is a hidden page that gets them $10,000. I guarantee your traffic will go up. You said that one already, too. You know what makes people really behave? Knowing that the guy they screwed over is going to be at the breakfast table in the morning. Mm-hmm. It's called iterative tit for tat. This comes out of game theory, which is a field that games end up having to pay a lot of attention to. As long as there's an expectation of future interaction. This is why it's really important to require people to register and have ongoing profiles and not be easily able to blow away their old profile and start over. In fact, negative reputation systems where you flag somebody as having been bad always degenerate into chaos. This has actually been studied by game theorists now. Positive reputation systems, they're game, they're everything else, and they always trend to stability. We made the mistake of having murder counts in our games. Bad idea. Any of you play The Sims? Sims, major mainstream success. Interesting thing. All the core gamers hate it. But they loved it enough to buy it and bring it home. And then they recommended it to their girlfriends. I'm not being sexist here. This is actually documented. They recommended it to their girlfriends, and the girlfriends played it to death. The path to the mass market is always through the hardcore, because the industry had no freaking clue how to market to the girlfriends. There was no way to reach the girlfriends. If you are trying to market to average housewife in Paducah, you're screwed. What you need to do is market to the person that she calls for tech advice. By the way, when you have a really kick-ass lead user, make sure you destroy him. Tiger Woods, Babe Ruth, Secretariat. They made the game miserable for everybody else. It really, really sucks when there's one person around who wins all the time. I mean, you all know this person, right? You hate them, don't you? Topple your kings if you want to have longevity. Turn over every leaderboard. Destroy every ranking. Swap it out and make sure whoever was successful last time is not successful again. Particularly important, any rich get richer scenario. like a social networking system where whoever's at the top gets even more links because, well, everybody wants to be connected to the guy who's at the top. We need to be able to blast Joey Ito off of Orkut in order for everybody else to keep playing Orkut. Yeah, we'll skip that one because I'm out of time. Yeah, we'll skip all of these. Oh, this one's a good one. Don't make your product perfectly polished. Perfection is dull. Players like feeling smart and finding something that you overlooked, something that you left unfinished, something they can exploit for a little bit of advantage. Everybody loves the fact that even though Amazon says they don't give you credit for buying something through their store when you're the associate, that slips through all the time. Right? Everybody makes money by buying things through their own associates link, and they all feel smart thinking that they made Amazon feel stupid. That's a good thing. You want users to feel smart. Oh, there's more things here, but whatever. If you want to know more about all of these kinds of things, you can go read the book, you can do whatever. I have a panel to go to that starts in 10 minutes. You're all welcome to phone me up.